Blog Talk Radio.
I lift up the jeweled breast. I lift up the amber lips. I lift up the shadowed eyes. I lift up.
Good evening and welcome, Gaias and fans of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Thank you for tuning in again this Wednesday, whether you're across town or across the globe. And happy Astara to you and yours. May the great She bestow upon you her many boons, leaving for you this coming weekend and into spring her brightly colored baubles of creativity, potential, and fertility in all its many forms. And if you want a little jump start to immerse yourself in the season, if you need a dose of spring fever, then please take advantage of the free spring meditations on my website. They're lots of fun, and they might help you tap into that vital life force. You can find them on the Goddess Store page of my website at KarenTate.com. They're absolutely free. There's no strings attached. I feel like Goddess gives us all so much. I want to give these to you in gratitude. So please download them and enjoy. And enjoy this time of rebirth. Use it to transform yourself. Use it to recreate yourself and your life. Well, tonight we have a double feature for you, so our time together is going to be jam-packed, I promise. At the top of the hour, we have a fiction author with us, which is very unusual for this show. We have Julie Raymond, author of a 7-book women's fiction series called We the Trees, set in Cappadocia. And if you don't recognize the name of that place, it's a region in what we call Turkey today, or it used to be called Anatolia, or Land of the Mothers. Which brings us to our topic. What if our genetic code contains a lot more information than eye color or tendencies toward disease? What if we have a genetic memory that allows us to unearth our ancestral memories and begin the greatest excavation of all time, remembering what was? And we then can document this in books of fiction, such as We the Trees, and share it with others. That sure makes me remember the impact a book called Myths of Avalon by Marion Zimmer Bradley had on me when I first discovered Goddess and Ancient Priestesses. These books of fiction allow us to stretch and grow, to rethink, remember, and reclaim important information from the past. Then, at the bottom of the hour, our topics are not totally unrelated. My most controversial guest is back. That's David Hillman. He calls himself the irate classicist. I think his ideas are right on and so thought-provoking. He, too, in his way, with all his years of research, is also opening new doors of remembering, rethinking, and reclaiming for us as we take a second look without the lens of Christianity warping our vision and understanding and see what the ancient Greeks really believed. With David, we're going to cover, as time allows, the most powerful goddesses, the Fates, Aissa. Well, he'll have to tell me if I'm pronouncing these right. Aissa, Eileithyia. And time permitting, we'll get into women in Dionysus or women who kindle the flame. And we can't ignore the Pope, the Church Fathers, Jesus, and naked boys. Now, you might say, weren't we supposed to discuss the movie Clash of the Titans? Well, yes, you'd be right, but the movie release date changed. So David, not wanting to disappoint, decided that he would come on this week, and he's also going to return next Wednesday, and we'll have that conversation about Clash of the Titans as promised, so you won't miss anything, I promise. Then time permitting, I'll get to what's the buzz, and our topics are an article from Maureen Dowd that ran in the New York Times called A Nope for Pope. Let's make a nun the Pope. She says nuns have historically cleaned up the messes of priests, so stay tuned for that. Then, very insightful comments from one of you listeners about the dumbing down of America and the part being played in that by Fox News and Rupert Murdoch. Then sort of piggybacking on that idea, what Kennedy said about the Fairness Doctrine in Fox News. Talking about dumbing down America in their haste and interest to be supreme homophobes, I'm wondering if you heard about what happened in Oklahoma. Well, attempting to strip gays of hate crime protections, Oklahoma removed protections for race and religion. That means themselves, too. Duh. Okay, yeah, I know it sounds crazy. I'll explain it. Then, to close off the What's the Buzz segment for some humor, I'd like to read you Eve's Talk with God. That's Eve's Talk with God. And I'll go over the upcoming guests in April, which include Foremother Eleanor Gadden, the author of The Once and Future Goddess. I'm sure many of you have her book on your shelves, as well as other great guests you will want to mark your calendars for. But before I forget, I want to be sure to show my gratitude to the artists who generously let me use their music for my show. And tonight's opening was Vale of Inanna by a group I really love their sound called Zingaya. Well, it's that time to get to our first guest. I don't want to keep Julie waiting any longer, so let me tell you a bit about Julie. Well, Julie believes a rich heritage is largely lying dormant in the consciousness of modern women. Recently, Julie began traveling the country leading circle workshops called Reclaiming Our Mothers, restoring in participants' awareness of the rich memory of the collective feminine passed down in the genetic inheritance we receive from our ancient mothers. Ancestral memory is the complete birthright of every woman who has ever lived. Embarking on the greatest excavation of all time, Julie wants to help women reclaim our mothers. She believes the central issue of our time is the rebalancing of the feminine and masculine. I totally agree. Integral to that rebalancing is the awakening of women as gender to their heritage, gifts, and voice. Her sole work for the past 17 years has focused on exploring the forgotten relationship between our ancient mothers with their modern daughters. Many years of deep soul work and research at home and abroad bore fruit in the form of a 7-book women's fiction series about ancestral memory Julia's writing called We the Trees. And the first book of that series is The Well of Time, which is now ready for publication, and she'll tell you more about that later. So, Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Well, I'm honored to be invited, Karen.
Well, you know, when you and I first started talking about potentially having you on the show, mm-hmm. what really sold me on the idea was the impact that book of Marion, Zimmer Bradley had on me, The Mists of Avalon. I couldn't put that book down, and it really helped me reclaim and remember and reimagine what it must have been like as an ancient priestess, you know, because we get these clinical descriptions of what it might have been like, or we get, you know, the idea that it was all this oppression, and of course David Hillman later is going to talk about it wasn't quite as oppressing as we think, you know, depending on where, you know, what parts of the world you lived in. But, you know, anyway, it just really you saw these ancient priestesses as real women living real lives, and I don't know, I just wanted to go back in time. I wish I had a time machine to experience the way they were living with the goddess and close to the earth, and it was beautiful. So I realized you're doing the same thing, and that's why I wanted to have you on the show so you could talk more about this work.
Well, thank you, and that's actually the very journey you've described is exactly the focus and intention that I am trying to have in my own life now, to live more simply and in connection with who we have been as a gender, and to bring that forward so that it can help us become architects of a new future.
Well, you know, maybe it's just I'm getting old and I'm mellowing or something, but, you know, all of the all the extra stuff, you know,
right.
All the technology, you know, this, it's just overdone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like it's such a distraction from what's really important, at least to me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like to say to people sometimes, when is enough enough? When will you ever just have enough, you know? And sometimes I think some people never will, you know? It's like this hole that never fills or something. But how did you get started doing this, Julie? Was it, I think you did actually take a trip to Turkey. Was that what inspired you? I mean, how did, you know, how did this become your passion?
This became my passion through a spiritual journey that honestly was defined by probably 10 years of downright absolute nightmares, literally. And I had these dreams. I know I can share this with your audience because I'm familiar with the format of your show and the tone, the spiritual tone of it. So to be guided by a spiritual influence wouldn't be a surprise to your listeners.
No.
And I would wake up, you know, with these nightmares. And at the time, it was very confusing to me because what I was receiving in the dreams seemed to be an absolute contradiction to what I had grown up to believe was right and worthy of my life. And but I never remember feeling that alignment with it without with that life path without conflict within myself. But these dreams were coming to me, and I would wake up like, and there would be old women in the dream standing at the end of my bed telling me I had to remember. And it took time for me to distill through all of that, that there was a message, and that if I just surrendered to the impulse that was trying to emerge through me, that I could learn something valuable not only to myself but to other women. And this has been a consistent theme for me. I shared at a women's conference last August something I received in a meditation that I'd like to share with your audience and with you. I was walking, because I think it's a metaphor for where we're at today as women.
Okay.
I was walking on a darkened path, and I was looking for something. And I came to this tree, and at the bottom of the tree, there was a hole in the ground. And I heard crying. And I went down on my stomach, down this warren-like tunnel down under the ground beneath the roots of the tree, and there was a woman lying in the fetal position. She was completely emaciated in this rounded out womb-like space deep in the earth under this tree. And she was talking to me, but I couldn't really hear her. So I got my face right up to hers, and her eyes were just, you know, our noses were virtually touching. And she said, "Get me out of here." And so I began to pull away all of the roots that were growing literally through her body. She'd been there so long. And I gathered her up in my arms and took her back up this warren-like tunnel up to the surface. And when I got up there, there were now women walking around in a circle, each of them carrying gifts. Some were carrying music. Some were carrying artifacts. Some were carrying memories. All of the women each had a different gift. And that when the women came together, the gifts made sense. And there was a larger picture, a deeper wisdom. But when they were separated, they looked smaller and possibly even insignificant to the women themselves. But together, they became this powerful, amazing mosaic of women as a collective body.
Wow, Julie, that's not only is that prophetic but and visionary, mm-hmm. but incredibly powerful. And I think you're right. You know, I think
mm-hmm.
I think that was definitely divine guidance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, telling you what's to come and what you're going to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Wow. Well, you know, it makes me think, too, you know, how you said she was emaciated. I was waiting to hear you say, you know, as, you know, probably the women circled her or something, you know, she, you know, became less emaciated. And it reminds me of a movie I saw of author in Guinevere and the Lady of the Lake, and it was sort of this, you know, this kind of Mists of Avalon theme, and they were talking about the old ways and the sacred feminine, and they were in the pagan ways, and they said, you know, when you don't give it attention, it fades away, and I think all of this attention, so many of us in so many different ways from so many different avenues, like you said, you know, some women bring the music, some women bring the healing. I mean, all of these different things we all bring to the table, you know, it is as if, you know, our remembering her is restoring her, you know, not just for her, but for us as well.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that.
You're welcome.
But I want to get more into, you know, the ancestral memory, you know, for, I mean, I totally get that, but in, just in case, you know, some of our listeners, you know, have a little trouble wrapping their mind around what that is, why don't you explain it a little bit?
Okay. Well, this is the central premise for the book series, and it is genetic heritage doesn't just encompass eye color, hair color, and tendencies towards disease, but that our complete birthright also includes talents, wisdom, personal memories, everything from our ancestry has been downloaded into who we are today on every level. So we have a spiritual memory, maybe, you know, physical memory of who we've been in the past, and the combination of genetic traits that come down to us through our from our ancestors.
Okay. Well, and I loved your flyer because you talked about Eve. Is it okay if I read this?
Yeah, sure.
You say, okay, what if we have a genetic memory? Through mitochondrial DNA, maternal ancestry can be traced back to a woman we have in common. Eve lived approximately 150,000 years ago in Africa. She is the most recent common ancestor of every person on Earth. Eve was not the sole female of her day. 20,000 women may have lived at the same time as Eve, but she's the only one who produced an unbroken line of daughters that persists today. The result is that Eve's mitochondria have progeny in the cells of modern human beings. This narrowing of the human family recreates the household of our distant familial relationship in a deep reservoir of ancestral memory stored in all of us. You know, as I read that, I was thinking about the times I've traveled to Egypt and how Egypt felt not foreign to me. And how can that be for a contemporary woman who's lived all her life in the United States? You know, back then I started thinking about this, that, you know, when we tap into some familiarity that has no real basis in logic, you know, I mean, after all, we didn't visit these places in our contemporary life, there's something is going on. I mean, I really do believe that.
I do, too. I do think that we have not only you know, Egypt is an interesting place for you to bring up because not only is there tremendous history there, I wouldn't be surprised, Karen, if you did some genetic research on yourself that you have lines that go directly there.
Let me just ask you that now. How does one trace their roots?
You can do it. There's two ways. You can do genetic testing through like Ancestry.com or somewhere, and all it is just a swab that grazes the inside of your cheek, and they can trace you back. The mitochondrial DNA is just fascinating to me because it doesn't really change, and like scientists like Janine Davis Kimball have used it in her archaeological sites to trace people who live around the digs that she found, like, you know, in Russia, to find modern descendants of the people who were buried there.
Okay.
It's fascinating to me.
And
the one girl that that I'm speaking of and specifically remembering lived in a community of people with dark hair, but she had blonde hair like the woman in the grave did.
Okay. So her ancestors, you know, she was carrying that gene, obviously, of her ancient ancestors.
Yes, she was carrying it. Uh-huh, yeah.
So, well, and you know, and also too, you know, and I guess it's why, you know, at least for me personally, I've always been drawn to that area of Egypt, that area of the Mediterranean, but more, even more lately to Turkey. I mean, I know when we did our last tour to Turkey, there was something powerful going on that
yes.
I couldn't language, especially
mm-hmm.
in a site that was sacred to Aphrodite called Aphrodisias. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Aphrodite had never really been like one of my primary goddesses. But, you know, there was just something happening that I mean, it just affected me on such an emotional level. It was like something, like some sort of reconnection. And I still can't describe it any better than that, but it was profound. You know, it's really hard sometimes to explain these things if maybe you haven't experienced them yet yourself.
It's true, and but I think that's part of the over-intellectualization of our brain,
mm-hmm.
is that what we feel, we don't trust the senses of the body to tell us things. So
mm-hmm.
it's the equivalent of being in a freezing room and denying that you're cold. You know?
Well, and I was thinking as you were talking about your meditation and you were talking
yeah.
about your dreams, in our society, you know, we're conditioned to not pay attention to that stuff. It's frivolous.
Yeah, that's very true. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, I mean, and you think about, I mean, I hate to use the Bible as an example, but so many people, you know, they don't dare question the epiphanies of the, you know, the ancient patriarchs.
Right.
And it's no different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, divine guidance is divine guidance. And, I mean, it's up to us whether we're going to pay attention to what, I think, what comes down to us. But I think it's important that we listen and,
yeah.
You know, with a discerning ear, you know.
And women can tap into that by recognizing that maybe they have a specific talent or something that they didn't really have to work for.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed to come to them. Or maybe you have an inner knowing about the body or about, you know, how to heal people emotionally or something. You just have this inner knowing, this inner sense, a deeper wisdom that seems to come from beyond yourself. And at that point, we can ask ourselves, were any of my ancestors carriers of this gift?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and you hear oftentimes, you know, like psychic gifts and things like that are passed from grandmother
yeah.
to, you know, granddaughter or
mm-hmm.
in families among twins, you know, different things like that. Well, you talk about ancestral memory. You call it the indigenous wisdom for modern times.
Yeah.
I love that, but explain it.
Well, you know, going forward, one of the things that I hope to do is to become very, very well acquainted with the traditions of indigenous European cultures, because I think that as European people of European descent, we our heritage is so mixed up and has been has suffered so greatly through war and various you know, social disturbances in that part of the world, that we don't see ourselves as indigenous people. We
mm-hmm.
don't see ourselves as an indigenous group. And so when we talk about indigenous people, we're talking about the other,
mm-hmm.
you know, someone else besides ourselves.
Right.
And the truth of the matter is that we have an indigenous root as well. And if we can accept and understand the contents of that root, what is it that root is passing down to us, I think it will make it easier for us and more, we'll have greater desire to live in harmony with other indigenous cultures, but also to accept the wisdom that comes from our own indigenous cultures.
So do you think by
yeah,
doing that DNA test, that sort of starts that thought process in a way? You
well,
know,
it certainly, yeah, it certainly connects you to not only to a group of people, but also to the land itself that
mm-hmm.
nourished your ancestors. I know I've been just blown away by what I've found in my own family tree. I've done a lot of research into that over the last year and a half, and I've traced some, you know, some of the lines back to, you know, 1063, but I've been fascinated by, first of all, I've always sensed that there was a, you know, like basically I really am a child of the earth, like there's a little bit of everything floating around inside me, and it's really pretty much true. And I have, like you do, Karen, I'm interested in this, that we both feel this connection to, you know, Asia Minor. mm-hmm. that there's something there calling to us. And I just find that in all the research that I did and the intellectual traveling that I did, that there was something about that place that was really calling me home. And so I explored it and found that there's such a cradle of feminine wisdom and history there that isn't acknowledged in the West. It isn't acknowledged in the West because the Greeks wouldn't acknowledge it, and we are a Greek society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and you're right. I mean, and even today, I mean, just looking at it from a practical perspective, it's such a wonderful place to go, mm-hmm. not only because it's this melting pot of cultures, and as you just described, but just from a very pragmatic point of view, they're not on the Euro yet. It's not overrun with tourists, you
right.
know, and it, but, you know, and so your experience can be so much deeper, and, you know, when if you go there with a group or something, you really can have, you know, private time and really sort of connect with these sacred sites. I mean, we're, you know, I know we're sort of talking about this on different levels, but then once you get there and you sort of let that left brain go, you know, you really
yeah.
can, you know, drop into your right brain mm-hmm. and really try to connect to this ancestral memory, you know, that that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And let your imagination experience the place.
Yeah, yeah, and really just
uh-huh.
don't judge it. I mean, I think
right,
that's
exactly.
key. You know, we really can't judge it. We just have to let the spigot flow, journal everything we can remember and write down, and then, you know, come back home and, you know, really sort of process it and see what gifts we were given, because no doubt we were given gifts. Well, you talk about the impact of what's been lost. You've used an expression similar to what I've used. You say we're orphans. And,
yeah.
you know, and I say, you know, oftentimes, you know, we're like children who've grown up without a mother, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you elaborate on, you know, how you feel about that?
Well, I certainly see women today as orphans to our heritage. We don't have a connection to our ancient mothers. We don't have a connection to ourselves as sisters who have come from those ancient mothers. And I think that as a gender, we suffer greatly because of that. And in turn, then, the world is denied the gift of our sisterhood. And, you know, if you're from European descent, that can be traced back to the burning times, that women... we turned each other in, honestly, under torture. We weren't able to trust each other. The burnings themselves and hangings were ritualized. In other words, it wasn't a private affair. The whole community was brought in to watch the woman die, and so everyone was affected and forced into silence and separation from the roots of our spiritual heritage. You know, from ancient times, and it was lost.
Well, you know, I've called that often. I don't know if other people have used the same phrase, but it was gender genocide, really.
It sure was gender genocide. There's no question.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. You know, and I hadn't really thought about that, Julie. I have to tell you how that those Inquisition days could have damaged our sisterhood, so to speak. And I know we're getting off track a little bit, but that seems like a good segue to talk about this event that you said is coming up in a few months, this March.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to add to that it is part of our genetic memory, that what was imprinted in our mothers back then, in our ancient mothers during the burning times, has carried down to us. That it's in our that I feel that it's in our genetic makeup. Our bodies remember what they felt during those
yeah.
times.
Yeah. Well, and couple that with the idea that the patriarchy tends to want us to compete with each other and not support one another and do the patriarchal thing, which is sort of maybe goes against our real nature in a sense.
Right.
And because, you know, I've said oftentimes, you know, if women could really stick together and not, you know, denigrate and compete and, you know, be squabbling at the bottom of the heap for the scraps, what a force we could be, you know, if we could
yeah.
all just, if we could all just sort of simultaneously get it, you know.
Right. A collective waking up.
Yes, 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 absolutely,
mm-hmm.
absolutely.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure we get back to the march, but you also wanted to discuss something about the original medicine of each woman. What is the original medicine?
Well, if we look at ourselves, there's an unbroken thread that links each of us to the women of the past. And when we lose touch with this, we lose touch with our sacred tie to ourself. If ancestral memory is blocked, we're blocked, and we forget who we are. We lose the power to tap into our intuitive guidance and in a timeless way, in a way that connects us to the timelessness of being female, of being human on this planet, of being a daughter of the earth, someone who eats food from the earth, lives in seasons and cycles just like the earth. And when we lose touch with that, we lose touch with the connection to our gift. What is the gift that only you can give? And it goes back to that meditation that we are each carrying something, and that your personal configuration of life experiences and memories, genetic and modern, make up that gift that you have to offer, and no one else will ever be able to offer that gift again.
Well, now, if this isn't too personal, and if it is, that's okay. You don't have to share. But did you, in the meditation, did you see what gift you were carrying? I'm just curious.
I feel, Karen, that I am carrying the gift of remembering.
Okay.
And sharing the revitalizing of our roots together. I feel that is my part.
Well, that's really important because I think we have so much to remember. We have so much to relearn, and so much has been swept under the rug that there's just so much out there waiting for us to restore our roots and reclaim that whole woman's heritage that unfortunately has been neglected, and so of course she's emaciated.
Yes. Well, a lot of what we learned as girls, especially in Western society, is that the gifts that we have as a gender, the innate gifts that we possess as a gender, are liabilities. To be compassionate, those gifts are the weaknesses, not strengths.
Well, and also too, because we tend to be, when we make decisions and when we look at the world, we look at things peripherally. How are our decisions going to affect other people? That is used against us, quite frankly. I think
divide and conquer.
Yeah, I mean that's why so many women, I think, stay in the oppressive religions like Christianity, because they're thinking, well, if I quit the church, how is that going to affect my family? How is that going to affect my social life? How is that going to affect everything that I've grown up believing? Rather than saying I will not be oppressed. And so effectively that perpetuates the patriarchy. It's good for the patriarchy, while it is actually not healthy, I think, for women, quite frankly. So we're thinking about the big picture before we think about ourselves. And so using our innate way of being against us, in a sense, for not for our own gain, really.
Well, if you think about it, the separation of women from one another is our nature is to be collaborative, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you can separate those who feel the need to be collaborative, you've disconnected them from one another and from their power, which is the collaboration itself.
Yeah, that's an important point. Well, I feel like this has all been important, but we've sort of glossed over your book, and I don't want to do that. So it's We the Trees, and I love the name because we know the goddess in so many cultures was first revered as a tree, the tree of knowledge, all of that good stuff. So tell us more about the series and the setting for the first book and how that's all coming along.
Okay, well, the first book is called The Well of Time, and essentially my heroine is the traveler. She's a modern woman who rediscovers her ancestral heritage, and in that heritage she was foretold by her ancient foremother, who lived 4,500 years ago in Turkey, what we call modern Turkey. And her ancient foremother was the mother of the blood circle. And that was her role in her tribe as a leader and woman of responsibility and wisdom. And so she foretold the coming of this ancient daughter as she could see the darkness descending upon her future daughters, that they would not have access to the sisterhood, to the gifts, to the memories, and that this traveler would be able to restore those roots. And so in modern times, this young woman is interested in archaeology, and she's a student. She goes to Turkey and joins a dig where an ancient artifact is discovered. And through the series, we actually come to realize her connection to this artifact, and that and also she's awakened to her role as the traveler. So through the book series, she rediscovers her own ancestral heritage and the ancestral heritage that we may share as modern daughters.
So throughout the whole book, does the whole series take place in Turkey, or will it go
No.
to other countries?
It'll go to other countries, but this first book does take place in Turkey.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. Wonderful. And where are things at with the book now? Is it possible?
Penguin has it, and they're reviewing it.
Okay. Well, you know what? Listeners out there, I think
yes.
you all agree you want to read this book. Please send good energy to Penguin that they decide
yes.
they offer you a book contract for this.
I would love that. Yeah.
Well,
and people can check out... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and to have Penguin publish it, that's not an easy feat. So that
No.
would be a great accomplishment.
Yes, it would. And I would love it if your listeners would go to my website. They can read chapter one there, and I'd love to hear their comments. It's wethetrees-bookseries.ning.com.
Okay. And you also have a blog, too, right?
Yeah, on the website.
And is the blog about the book series, sort of?
It's about the book series and about related issues like new discoveries in DNA or I don't know if you're aware or not, but I posted a story about the Turkish scientists who managed to germinate a lentil seed that was 4,000 years old. And the genetic makeup of that seed is completely different than modern lentil seeds. And I just find that as a fascinating metaphor for us as women anyway, that there's something 4,000 years old waiting to come to life inside us.
Mm. Well, and I think, too, this idea of remembering and reclaiming and rethinking,
yes.
it feels so authentic to so
mm-hmm.
many of us. It doesn't feel foreign at all. It's almost like we're obsessed. It's a mission.
It is. It is a mission. It is our time. I really believe it is time to remember. It is time to remember now.
Well, I know when I first was doing this, I thought, how odd, I must be. But, the more and more women I've met, now this is the norm, quite frankly,
mm-hmm.
At least it feels that way, to me, and I'm sure to you too, Julie. Well, tell us, we probably have about five minutes more or so.
Okay.
And I know you wanted to talk about that march or the walk that's coming up.
Well, it's amazing what happens when you sit with women and talk and are authentic with one another, because things bubble up that are trying to emerge. And I was in L.A. In February with a group of women, and we were sitting around at lunch. We had just been to Sister Giant, and we were talking about just, the state of the world and the gifts of women and how could we mobilize the sisterhood of women. And we began to realize that maybe it's not just about mobilizing the sisterhood of women, it's about hearing where we're at together, and that hearing where we're at together will help us to develop the plan for going forward as sisters, reconnecting to one another and listening to one another's stories. And, we kind of express ourselves in modern times through walking. There's all kinds of walks you can do
mm-hmm.
for breast cancer and so many other causes. And if we really want to change the course of our country and the course of the world, then we really need to rediscover ourselves as a gender and our relationship to one another as women. What kind of a world would we create together? I don't think we know at this stage, because we don't know each other well enough. So we thought, what if we had a walk from, say, Huntington Beach, California, or San Francisco to Washington, D.C., and if we walked all the way, that women could join along at along the route, wherever they live, in whatever part of the country they're in, walk for the distance that feels good to them, but join the conversation. And by the time we got to Washington, we'd have a deeper connection and a better idea of what it is that we really want to do. You know, by listening to one another's stories and getting to know each other, becoming sisters, laughing, crying, hearing how it is for one
right.
another, and developing a plan. You know, let's get that oxytocin really pumping and see what happens.
Well, you know, so, I'm thinking the wonderful moving meditations that could be done along the
yes.
way.
Yes, oh, absolutely. And so this event is just taking off. Women are just responding to it like crazy. We're getting ready to begin launching our website. If anyone wants to be in communication with me about my book or about the walk, they can contact me at wethetrees@yahoo.com. And I also have a Facebook page, We the Trees on Facebook. And people are very welcome to contact me there about any of the things we've talked about today. I'm very open to communication, and I really, really feel that it is the sisterhood, the rediscovering of our sisterhood that will propel us into a better future.
Well, and, you know, as I'm hearing you think about this, you know, oftentimes in some of the classes I've taught, you know, I've asked women as an assignment or homework, go home and reimagine what the world would be like with Goddess restored to the center. And, you know, it's really not easy a lot of times for these women to imagine what that would be like, you know, because
no.
we're so caught in this, how things are now. I don't think we've given ourselves permission. I think that's really important. We haven't given ourselves permission to reimagine that there could be anything else. You know, we've been duped into the idea of the way we live today is the only way we can live, and you know, the reality that we have today is the only reality, and it's the real reality and the true reality. When, you know, that's all, you know, just the words aren't coming to me, but it's
a lie.
Thank you.
It's
a lie, and I think it's also programming. You know, it's the programming to keep us, you know, us little sheeple on the straight and narrow, and, you know, not to make waves. But we do. Yeah, you know, I mean, I would say to women everywhere, and you've been saying this the whole time we've been talking, give ourselves permission to reimagine, reconstruct.
Right.
You know, a new world. What is that going to look like? You know, we really need to start visioning that.
Well, the other thing is let's be real. I don't think any of us are insulated from the fact that the reality that we of what we're experiencing together is dismantling around us.
Right.
It's
right.
dismantling, and that the future that we create is not a one-woman show. Any woman who's listening to this and feels a little intimidated, like she may not be able to connect with her gift, she may not be able to do it, the truth is you're not alone. This is only going to happen, in my humble, very humble opinion, I'm offering this, but I feel that this is not going to happen as a one-woman show. This is something we will do together. It's like cleaning up the kitchen, you know, together after an event. Some of us will do the dishes. Some of us will do the floor. You know,
right.
Some of us will take care of the table. But together, well, we're going to have a good time because we're going to talk and we're going to chat together, you know, and laugh and giggle. And pretty soon the work will be done.
Well, you know what? You're so right. And I'm getting goosebumps as I'm hearing you talk about this because, I mean, look, even the Dalai Lama came out and said he's a feminist and it's Western women that are going to save the world. And it's,
I love it that the Dalai Lama is a feminist.
I know. I just love it. That gives other men all over the world permission to be feminist, too.
It is. Uh-huh. And really, what does that mean? All that means is that you respect the feminine.
Well, it was, and you know, and you're interested in a caring culture, you know,
right?
And
yeah.
So, I mean, and God, what's it seems so insane to me that people could demonize that idea. But you know, of course, I mean, look at what's happening in the news. I mean, people can't even see. People are trying to do good things for them, and you know, they want to carry guns and you know, throw bricks in windows, you know, because
right.
people are trying to do good things for them, and they can't even, you know, see the forest for the trees. Well, Julie, thank you so very much for being
on
the
welcome.
Show. And let's go ahead and give out your contact information one more time.
Okay. My website is WeTheTrees, W-E-T-H-E-T-R-E-E-S hyphen bookseries.ming.com. And WeTheTrees is a Facebook group, and my email is WeTheTrees@yahoo.com.
And if women wanted to do that that DNA test, you said it was Ancestry.com?
Ancestry.com is one place that offers it. Uh-huh.
Okay.
That's a reliable place to get it, yeah.
Okay, and any idea, do you remember how much it cost?
$163, I think.
Oh, well, that's not too bad, because I heard at one point it was almost $400. So.
Yeah, it used to be. It's coming down in price as more people do it.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, Julie, thank you so very much for being on the show.
Oh, you're welcome.
And as it gets closer to that March, we'll have you back on. And
oh, that sounds great.
Okay. All right. So listen, thank you so very much, and good luck with the book. I am metaphorically right here in my mind, in my third eye. I am lighting a candle that Penguin sends you a book contract, and you know, before the end of April, you have your name on the dotted line.
Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you.
Okay.
And I send my love to all my sisters out there.
Thank you so much, Julie. Thank
mm-hmm.
you for being on the show.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks will save the world. You've just been listening to Julie Raymond, author of the fictional series, helping us to revive our forgotten ancestral roots through this series called We the Trees. So if you liked what you heard Julie talk about, if you'd like to read beyond that first chapter she offers on her blog, if you want to actually dig deep into that series, send her good energy that Penguin or another publisher picks up that contract and offers her the chance to get it all out to us. I actually read some of that book, and it was really wonderful. It put me back, like when I read The Myths of Avalon, you know, what it was like in these ancient times and these matriarchal societies, you know, with powerful women. Well, it's about that time. Listeners, we are crossing the threshold into the bottom of the hour, and I'm going to take a brief one-minute music break to get ready for the What's the Buzz segment and for our second guest tonight, David Hillman. And for that minute, I am going to leave you listening to, let's see, what's it going to be tonight? You know what? You haven't heard Choose Love by Laura Kane in a long time. So for 1 minute, stay tuned with me, because you know my second guest tonight is always interesting. He has the prestigious claim of garnering the most comments of any past guest contributors to my Examiner column, and when he's here on the show talking to you, I get lots of feedback. So don't go away. Here's Choose Love by Laura Kane, and I'll be back in just 1 minute.
I say I will. I'll take the ride, 'cause I'd rather have connections, pleasure and pain than be alone here with my pride. Okay, I'll take my shot. This time I'll take my chance, 'cause that's all I have left.
Staying tuned in. And it is my pleasure to have with me again David Hillman. I am David, are you with me on the line? Okay, hang on. Let me get him on the air. Hey, David, can you hear me?
Hello, Karen. Yes, I can.
Oh, good, good. It's my pleasure to have you here on the show again. I want to refresh everyone about your bio and a little bit about you. David earned his MS in bacteriology and an MA and PhD in classics from the University of Wisconsin, where he was asked to remove a chapter about recreational drugs from his dissertation on Roman pharmacy. He did so, and then he published his findings with St. Martin's Press in 2008, the result being his book, The Chemical Muse, Drug Use and the Roots of Western Civilization. He's currently working on a second book concerned with drugs, women, and the foundations of Western civilization, and he's recently been invited to present his findings at Boston University, where classicists now recognize the reality of recreational drug use and how important it was as the ancient Greeks and Romans used it. So, David, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Karen. It's a huge pleasure for me to be here. So, go fire away. Let's start talking about some goddesses.
Okay. All right. Well, where do you want to start tonight? Do you want to start talking about those goddesses whose names I'm sure I butchered at the top of the hour? how do you pronounce AISA? And is the other one Eileithyia?
Yes, you can say Eileithyia, that's fine, or Eileithyia. Either way is fine. You know, scholars really don't know how that stuff was pronounced anyway, the ancient Greek. But Aissa, I say her name Aissa, but she's actually a very unknown goddess. As a matter of fact, she's part of the pre-Olympian divinity. So she's one of the oldest goddesses that we know, kind of in the rank of Gaia. But I would argue even more antique than Gaia. So Aissa is fine.
Okay. Well, so you're dangling the carrot. You told me the Fates, Aissa and Eileithyia, some of the most powerful goddesses. While I'm sure some of the listeners are somewhat familiar with the Fates, enlighten us, because I know you always have more to say than is in our mythology books that we know now. You've been teaching us, they're warped a bit because of the Christian lens. So what do we need to know about the Fates, Aissa and Eileithyia?
Yeah, they're warped a lot. They're completely, what you understand about mythology, what we understand about mythology is seen completely through the Christian lens. So a lot of it has to just be forgotten and dropped. We have to get to what the Greeks actually thought. But here are several beautiful goddesses. And again, Aissa and Eileithyia, they've kind of been ignored, and I don't know why, because they should be central to women's studies. But as a matter of fact, I can promise you, Karen, that if you go on campuses across this country, that people who do classics or who do classical archaeology, they will not know who Aissa is. And she is such a well-respected goddess that even Zeus himself bends his knee to Aissa. So the question is, who is this goddess, and what kind of worship did she involve? But if we go back to the Fates, I think we can really see who Aissa is through the Fates.
Okay.
And so what I'd like to do is look at the Fates. Who are these three sisters, and what did they really do? Well, you know, before Christianity took root in Western civilization, the Greeks and the Romans came up with this concept of these three sisters who, you know, when everybody's born, they have a certain, they're all allotted certain attributes. They all have certain characteristics. And these three goddesses kind of, they follow you throughout life. They weave the images of a weaver. And I think this is beautiful. I think this, and this gets back to your previous guest. She was talking about memory. And I think this is very, very important, because the Fates are pictured as these three goddesses who kind of weave a tapestry of your life, and that your life can be a beautiful thing, or as we know, it can be an ugly thing, or
mm-hmm.
a thing full of shame and dishonor and hubris, or it can be something full of recognition of the gods and honor and what we would call piety. That's kind of a Christian expression, but kind of a respect for the gods. Well, anyway, these Fates weave this, and they're portrayed always as women. There are never male Fates. So I think that's important. But Aissa stands as kind of, literally, she is the goddess who brings your life to completion. She is the one who, she is the central element of your life. She is the, if your life is a story or a movie, Aisa is the point to that story.
Oh, okay. So she's sort of, I'm thinking it's sort of like when we talk about our purpose in life, she's the one who gives us that. Am I on the right track there?
Exactly. No, you're always on the right track. You always take what I say and then you distill it out to what is the most central point is, and that's why I love you so much. But you're exactly right. She is the punctuation on your life. She is the moral of your life, of the story of your life. That is Aisa. She gives you that, if you want to call it purpose or central message to your life, and it's not always good. It's sometimes quite bad.
Yeah, so in other words, if we were put on this, on Earth this time around, and it wasn't intended to be happy for one reason or another, is that what you're actually saying? That, you hear people say, disabled people, as one example, they're suffering in this life, but they're here to teach other people tolerance and compassion, something like that. Or is that sort of what you're getting at?
Yes, it is, but ramp it up even more than that. Aisa is the point that she takes your life and gives you meaning. And when I say that, I mean, there are a lot of bad people out there whose lives come to a point that people can look at their life and say, wow, what a bad person. And that is Aisa. She grants that to the individual. She takes your little life and she creates a message for the rest of humanity. And if that message is bad, well, that's, tough cookies, because that's Aisa. And even the king, the leader of the Olympians, the age of agriculture and human cities, even the Olympians has to bend the knee. Even the leader of the Olympians has to bend the knee to Aisa, because she is the one who declares whether or not your life has been full of hubris. Again, there's no concept of sin in antiquity before the Christians. There's no concept of sin. There's a concept of hubris and impiety towards the gods. That is making yourself a god and saying and not acknowledging the universal forces that exist.
You're much better off being humble in the ancient world.
Not even humble, Karen, because that's a Christian virtue again. It's
okay.
Not humble. It's a recognition. Women who were oracles because they were able to see the ether.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds crazy. It sounds weird or something. But that's a fact from the plays and from the writings that we have about these Greeks, the Greek tragedies and whatnot. It's the ether that's important. Women who can see into the ether, that is kind of the composition of the universe. Women who are able to understand where the immortals move and how they move, those are the women that approach the divine. Mm. Not all people do that, and many people focus on themselves and they focus on getting money or they focus on being happy. The gods don't care if you're happy. They don't care if you have money, according to the Greeks. Anyway, Aisa doesn't. Aisa wants to make a point of your life. And if your life is full of shame and greed and trying to become something that you're not, then she puts a punctuation, an exclamation point on your life, and shows, because she's a goddess, that's what she has the power to do, she shows that what you've done is live a shameful life. And that's just as important as taking a good life and showing that, hey, this is what this person has been pious towards the gods. This person is recognized. This person has vision. I guess that's what I'm getting to, is the most important thing in antiquity is that vision, that understanding. And for some reason, women have a capacity, according to the Greeks, to tap into Aisa, the vision, the ether that's granted to them, that's given to them. It's a natural gift.
So how did we lose her? I mean, how did she disappear? Because I certainly haven't heard about her before you introduced her to me.
Yeah, you know what? Mostly because the Olympian cult kind of incorporated her use attributes into the pantheon of the Olympians kind of absorbed her. And when we're looking at these ancient texts, it's hard to bring her out. It's hard to really, we have to really be watching. She's the same as, I'm going to give you the name of another goddess. This is, I'm giving away this information to classes, just to let them have it. I don't care. Hosea.
Hosea.
Yeah, Hosea. You know what she is?
No.
She's the goddess of natural law. Isn't that strange?
Natural law.
Yeah,
so you're talking about like nature's law as opposed to man-made law?
Exactly. She's the goddess who protects the bond between a mother and a child, Hosea. You don't mess with a mother and a child. There's certain forces. People's law may not protect a mother and a child completely, but Hosea's law, you can't violate that. It's a natural principle that exists. You get between a bear and her cubs, you're going to get eaten.
Right.
And that's according to the law of Hosea. And again, Zeus bends the knee to Hosea. And these great goddesses of antiquity, we just don't want to focus on them. We just don't want to see them. And a lot of classes just ignore them entirely, and which to their own shame.
Well, do you think they ignore them, David, because of, you know, just this, you know, even though they're intelligent, studied men, I mean, is it as simple as the idea, you know, they've sort of subconsciously been brainwashed that the feminine is less than the masculine, therefore doesn't warrant their time?
Yeah, you know, good question. You can't study these ancient, the ancient Greek holy writings, sacred writings. You can't study them and not have complete respect for the goddesses. You can't. The fact that classicists can do that, I think, is a reflection of the fact that we look at all of these texts through the Christian perspective. And so naturally we want to denigrate women. We want to say that women can't be, for example, you can't be a priestess if you're within the Christian or Jewish cults, within the Christian or Jewish religions. You can't. It's forbidden by the text. But the Greeks didn't even, you know, to them the priestess was, some of these priestesses were immensely powerful.
Well, so what you're saying, I mean, and forgive me if this is like just overly obvious, but as we're looking at all of this through the Christian lens, not only has the female goddesses been denigrated and women oppressed, but the whole idea of the power of these ancient goddesses has sort of swept, you know, I always use that expression, swept beneath the rug, because the only thing that matters through this Christian lens is God and Jesus.
Exactly. It's an orthodoxy that says you must believe X, Y, and Z, and that nature is not supreme. And that's the difference, is the Greeks knew that nature was supreme. And it's not just the Greeks. I mean, you can talk about the Sioux if you want to, venerating nature. So, yeah, it's a detachment from the natural world. And a good example of that is Eleusio that we talked about. We often talk about her as the goddess of childbirth. And that's so primitive and so simple, such a simple way of describing her and her attributes. And I think it's important for Westerners to start to stand back and say, wait a minute, the concepts upon which democracy and the scientific method are built are not Christian concepts. And Eleusio is a perfect example of that, and Aisa and Hosea and whatnot. That these, and again, Karen, you always talk about balance, and you talked about balance tonight. I listened to you, and you talked about balance, and I think that's something that the Greeks really understood that we don't. And let me give you a strong female example of that. Themis, she is the goddess of justice, essentially, justice and right judgment. And And when the agricultural age emerges, you know, Zeus is a representative of the agricultural age, the building of cities. And the first thing that he does is to get an advisor. And who does he get as an advisor? He gets Themis, right? She is the one who controls the oracle at Delphi. She is the one who has the knowledge of this oracular knowledge that comes ultimately from Earth, from Gaia. But she's actually a judge. Her position is actually that of a judge. You can't build colonies without her okay. You can't expand as a society without her okay. You can't have just judgments and law courts without Themis.
Right.
So the idea that the age of the city is joined, is married to the concept of justice, that's a balance between the masculine and the feminine, definitely.
Absolutely. Well, I can see that so clearly. And again, it's never really been put to me that way. We're going back to because the Christian lens has made these concepts, it has taught us that they're unimportant. They're not worthy of study, I guess.
Right. And a lot of it is taught that women are not worthy of, you think about menstruation. I hate to keep pounding this, but I read documents all the time, untranslated Greek that's all about menstruation, how to manipulate menstruation, how to cause abortions, for the sake of for healthcare reasons. And menstruation is central in the mind of the ancient Greek, especially the ancient Greek priestesses. It's central. You can't ignore menstruation, but it's always positive. It's never negative. In all of these texts that I've looked at, I'd never see menstruation referred to as something negative. As a matter of fact, at some point in the cycle, the Greeks preached, they believed, that a woman entered into a period of ecstatic vision that far exceeded the potential of their male counterparts. And that's why the males became just the bodyguards for these females who could enter the state during the cycle and manipulate it to the point of being able to give out oracles. So the magic of menstruation has somehow through Christianity become the sin, the mm-hmm. stigma, the stigma. Women are unclean.
Well, yeah, and it's not just the vision, like you say, it's the life force, for heaven's sake. And, to me, it just all goes back to Christianity is all about turning nature on its head, taking everything that's natural and making it somehow dirty or shameful. And I don't know if this is the time to segue into the Pope and the Church Fathers, but it felt like it, because when you were talking about, the Greeks knew that you had to revere natural law. I mean, to me, I look at the headlines today, what's going on with the Pope and all the pedophilia. It's because am I oversimplifying this? It's because they have gone against, what is just natural for men and women to do. They've denied these men sexuality. That they have to what's the word? They can't have celibacy. Thank you. They have to be celibate, and that's just not the natural state for human beings. And right. So this is the consequence, isn't it?
Once again, you hit the nail on the head, and that's because I swear to God, you have to tell your audience. Your audience has to understand that you have an insight that constantly proves itself. Let me show you. Let me show you exactly what I mean. Yes, it is against nature. The earliest Christian fathers, the church fathers, we're talking about people like Cyril of Jerusalem. We're talking about Irenaeus. They talk about catechism. And catechism originally is just a term. It's a term in Greek that means indoctrination. So
okay.
get this. The pagans. I hate to call them pagans, because when we call people pagans, it's like saying the N word or something.
Yeah, I know. It has this negative connotation, but probably not to my listeners. They know better.
Yeah, right. but so we talk about the pagans who are around the Christians who are early. We're talking about second, third, fourth centuries. CE, and they were criticizing the Christians, and they say most of these documents have been destroyed, but fortunately the Christian fathers preserved some of them for the sake of argument. And these early pagans, we'll call them, they talk about how dangerous Christianity is. For example, they said these priests will go out and they'll just take kids off the street. They'll take young boys off the street, little kids that have been abandoned or don't have parents, they're poor. And they'll take advantage of them. They say they'll take them and they'll put them through catechism. And they have this whole crazy, Cyril talks about this, Cyril of Jerusalem talks about this. And again, we're working up to the Pope.
Okay.
But Cyril of Jerusalem talks about what do you do during one of these catechisms? Well, you put these young boys through exorcisms. Now, I'm going to tell you what happens in an exorcism. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm taking this directly from the text, so you can verify this all. It's in Cyril of Jerusalem on catechism. He says, you take the boys, you start to instruct them, you sleep deprive them for 3 days. You take away their food, put them through fast for 3 days. You march them into a room, a sequestered place where only the priests have access. You take off their clothes. And again, he says they shouldn't be ashamed because just as Jesus was naked on the cross, now they're naked, right? He says, then you blindfold them. And this is where it starts. When I first read this, I thought, oh, my God, this is terrible. But you blindfold them, and then you take the holy exorcism oil, and you anoint them from head to toe.
Okay.
So you got to get the picture of the priest.
I'm getting it.
Okay, you're getting it. Fine.
Yeah.
You don't need to explain it. And then what do? You have to call up Lucifer, okay? And when you do that, Lucifer can then present the temptation to these young boys, right? So what Lucifer does is somehow in this ceremony, they call up Lucifer, and Lucifer himself tempts the boys. He, quote, puts them through the fire. Now the priest, Cyril of Jerusalem, he's a bishop actually, he tells these young boys who apparently are suffering some pretty severe psychological trauma, he says, don't worry if you are actually involved in the sexual act during this process, because if you do not consent, you have not sinned. That this is a temptation, this is a testing time, it's a time of fire. And so that you're being put through the fire, even if you do have to engage in sexual activity with this priest who is called up Lucifer, I'm not kidding you, it's all in the text, then you're still innocent. You've proven yourself that you're worthy of communion.
Oh, David, it's worse than I imagined.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And you know what I'm seeing? I'm seeing as you're describing this, I can't get out of my mind these recent pictures of the Pope on television with those dark circles around his eyes and those beady little eyes. He looked like a demon, you know? And I'm seeing him, you know, putting these boys through catechism. The perversion of this is so sick. It makes me so angry, David. I mean, how could this stuff have escaped the mainstream world? I mean, if this sort of information had not escaped the mainstream world, would these people be in these positions of power today?
Well, you're asking the same question the pagans were asking in the 4th century, 3rd, 4th centuries. You're asking the same questions. How do these priests get away with this stuff? And what is the justification? How can you possibly put a kid through something like that and feel that you've done some sort of theological blessing? You know, how do you justify this kind of stuff? Well, they
did. It's warped. I mean, it's just warped. I mean, it's just an excuse. To me, it sounds like an excuse for pedophilia.
Well, you know, okay, you said it, not me, but you know, as a scholar, as a historian, I just have to bring out the history. And you say, Karen, you say, what is the justification? What is the precedent? Is there precedent? Well, let me remind your listeners that in the book of Mark, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 14, verses 51 and 52, there is a controversy that the Christians took the better part of about 4 centuries to try to explain. Let me quote you the text. Are you ready? This is in your Bible, people, so go to your Bible and look it up because it's there. Mark 14, 51 and 52. Are you ready?
Yeah.
A young man was following him. That is Jesus. Okay, where is Jesus? He's in the Garden of Gethsemane. Remember, this is Mel Gibson's great temptation when he steps on a snake and all that kind of stuff. This is right before Jesus gets arrested, right?
Okay.
The authorities are coming. He's in the garden. Three of his disciples are standing at a distance armed, quote, keeping watch, okay? They have swords, apparently. Remember, Peter has a sword. He cut off one of the guy's ears who came. So he's in a public garden after dark, right? It's one of the late watches of night, so probably about 2 o'clock in the morning. He's in the Garden of Gethsemane, and this is what happens. He's off at a distance. The apostles, you know, are keeping guard. And he's off at a distance, quote, you know, wrestling with temptation. And what happens, quote, check the Bible, a young man was following him, and that word for young man is nanniskos. It's a kid literally from the Greek, it's a kid who's in his early teens, okay, if not about 10, 11, 12 years old. So somewhere between 10 and 16, 17. A young man was following him, says the text, wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body. And they seized him, that is Jesus. So the authorities got there, they grabbed Jesus, right? And they grabbed this kid, and it says he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped naked. So Jesus himself is arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane with a naked boy wearing a linen sheet, which, by the way, the linen sheet is also used by the church fathers in their exorcisms. It is a holy garment. As you know, linen was even holy to Isis.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a representative of kind of a purity, a garment.
Yeah, purity, yeah.
Purity, yeah, exactly. So when people arrested Jesus, they actually arrested him in the company of a naked minor.
So are they trying to imply there was anything happening with Jesus and this young boy?
Well, see, that's the thing. We have to ask that question. That's the evidence we have. That's what the texts say. Were the priests looking back on this this encounter that Jesus was having with a naked boy, and saying, well, this is something that we need to mimic? Now, I've been thinking about this for about 3 years now, trying to figure out what was going on, and I can tell you one thing, and I think this is related, that there is an ancient practice of ancient magic called hydromancy. And hydromancy involves the use of a young person in order to divine kind of sacred truths. And what it looks like is that the Christians were actually using hydromancy, but in their own sexual way, to justify what they were doing. Because bringing yourself to orgasm was considered to be an avenue of higher reckoning, higher learning. And so what it looks like to me, and from the Secret Gospel of Mark, which is something you can watch on Nova, they talk about this, the extended Gospel of Mark, where Jesus actually had a relationship with a young man, a young boy. It looks like he was trying to promote some kind of, you know, whatever. He was with a naked kid. I mean, that's obvious. But was he justifying it by asserting old rites of hydromancy? Well, that's a different question. I think something was going on. It's some sort of religious practice, or at least it's being justified as a religious practice. Now, the pagans, Karen, would never have done that. They drew the line. They drew the line with sex and children. That was absolutely verboten. And people, and that's the thing. Through the Christian lens, we think, oh, they were all. They said it was okay, you know, Zeus and Ganymede. No. There are actually laws in antiquity that somebody who's prepubertal, you cannot mess around with them. That's the physicians even say it's something legal system should prohibit, because having sex with somebody who's prepubertal is damaging to them physically. That's what they taught anyway. So
this raises a couple questions, okay? And the two that I'm remembering, I wish I knew shorthand so I could be writing these down. So the first question is: does hydromancy, if Jesus was trying to practice hydromancy with this young boy, hydromancy, I think you said, was some sort of divination. If he is the Son of God, why does he have to use a child to divine? Wouldn't he be able to have his own direct connection? Is number one.
Okay.
The second thing I'm thinking of, so do the priests, because they look back on this potential homosexuality or pedophilia, and they decide celibacy is the way to go because they've read these things, and they, you know, so they're going in the, you know, the total opposite extreme.
Yeah, you know what? I think, you know, those are both two excellent questions, and you know what? I honestly, Karen, I can't answer them because I just don't know. I don't know. But what I can conjecture from what I've studied is that there's such a close association between a priest who's trying to offer an avenue away from sin. So the concept of sin is there. And we have to somehow get the congregation away from sin. One of the ways of diverting a human soul away from sin is to offer temptation. So did it really have to do with divination, or was it just an excuse for priests to get, you know, their jollies with little children? I don't know, and I can't say. But it sure looks like what they were doing was using hydromancy as an excuse, because the pagans would have said, never would you ever have contact sexually with a child, ever, for the sake of divination. Absolutely not.
Okay, so the question about the pagans and pedophilia, what's the difference between, I'm remembering, you know, the show on Sparta when they talk about the young boys are taken away from their mother and they're put under the care of, you know, of an older man. And you get the, you know, you sort of wonder, well, how much was this older man supposed to teach this young boy? And then, the, you know, and then because the boys have grown up all their lives, you know, in the company of men and not women, they have a hard time adjusting to, you know, marriage and doing their duty as Spartans to reproduce. Are we looking at the same thing, or are we looking at something different? No. It, could that have been, I mean, was there maybe pockets where pagans were pedophiles as well?
You know what? I'm sure that pedophilia is universal throughout culture. So there's got to be pagan pedophiles, just like there were Christian. But the pagans never used it as a justification for a religious practice, whereas the Christians did. And the difference that we see is, again, through the Christian lens, we're kind of hampered by this. If we destroy the Christian lens, we look at pagans. Remember, when these kids are going to school, they're stripping down naked and wrestling with each other in the gymnasia anyway.
And that was normal. It wasn't a big deal.
Right. And men are considered across Greece. This is, you know, it differs a little bit from city-state to city-state. But generally, men are considered to experiment. As a teenage boy grows up, it's considered normal for him to experiment with other men. And when I say experiment, I mean more like, at least it's depicted on pots and whatnot, it's more of a playful, you know, you have a friend that you become attached to, and you kind of learn through each other sexually, but you don't commit to a, like what we would call a homosexual relationship until later teens. And then there's definitely, when these young warriors go off to war, we don't have to question that, yeah, Achilles and Patroclus were definitely male lovers. That's understood. But this was considered a preparation for marriage, and that men had to learn slowly over time. This isn't a 45-year-old male sequestering a young boy in the rectory of a church and sodomizing him. As a matter of fact, there's laws against that in antiquity. As a parent, you could sue in court. You could bring somebody to account for justice if they raped your kid like that. That was a no-no. You can't do that. So the relationships are different. They're more like teaching relationships as opposed to actual sexual encounters. So,
well, and I'm also seeing it's this male authority figure, too, that is the servant of God that, you know, I'm sure these young people felt that they had to acquiesce to. So it was, I don't know, almost like psychological blackmail or something too. You know, I don't know, maybe I'm overstating it, but I don't know, that's what it feels like to me.
No, you're not overstating it. It's definitely a method of control, and that's one thing that Greeks were definitely against is, look, the difference between a free person and a slave is the fact that a slave has no control over their body. So you can smack a slave around, and that's not considered illegal, but you can't smack a free person around. And to violate somebody sexually, like a kid, physically like that, like the priests were doing to boys, that was considered an act that you would perpetuate on somebody that you were taking away their freedom, essentially.
Right,
So for the Greeks, that was a big no-no. And again, Karen, it's hard for people to understand, but you could be prosecuted in Greek courts for having relationships that these priests were having, if you can call them relationships, for having encounters that these priests were having with boys. So there's a huge, huge difference. It's almost as if the Christians took the act of sex itself and took it out of nature, just like you said, and made it something that was illicit and
perverted.
Yeah, perverted. Exactly.
So, okay, so if this was commonplace, all right, how in the world did people like Constantine ever decide that going with Christianity was the way to go? I mean, how did it survive, I guess, is what I want to know. How did it overcome paganism if, you know, they had all of these dark secrets? And we know about all the, you know, the horrible popes and, you know, people that came down the road. One of them, you know, had a baby with his sister. And, I mean, you know, these were warped individuals. I mean, how did they get power?
According to the pagans who lived at the time that Christianity was taking over, say, 3rd and 4th centuries CE, it was all money and power. And that's essentially, I think that that's an accurate account. When you get a group of people who suddenly have tremendous authority and have state control, well, you know, does it matter what they do? It's a question of power. And when the first thing the Christians did was infiltrate the military and take over the military. And, you know,
déjà vu.
Yeah, right. Right, exactly. And as part of this takeover, they grabbed power. And once the Christian, then they took over teaching and
brainwashing.
Yeah, exactly. And once they started taking over the teaching, well, then the whole kind of foundation of the classical world started to crumble. And I'm not the one saying this. The pagans who lived at the time, as they saw this takeover happening, they were screaming about it too, because women were being dragged out in the streets and killed for committing abortions. You know, nothing new under the sun. You know, but they were complaining as well. So.
Well, you know, you're opening up a whole new window for me. You know, I have to tell you. I mean, I knew that there was a lot about Christianity I didn't like. You know, I've called myself a recovering Catholic. But knowing this sordid history, it just makes it, I mean, it goes beyond the Inquisition and the Crusades and the homophobia and the pedophilia. I mean, it just puts it in a whole new light. You know, it's not this gentle religion that came up from Jesus who was about love. You know, I mean, it was really pretty warped, at least by the time you're talking about.
Yeah, no, and all you have to do is look at the guy named Julian. He was actually an emperor of Rome, and he was the last pagan to try to revive paganism against Christianity. The Christians actually came in and killed all of his male family members. I think it was 8 members in general, his brothers, all this kind of stuff. Like this. He was only 7 or 8 at the time, and so he was spared. He was sent off to a monastery, and he swore that he would bring back paganism, because paganism, according to him, taught freedom and liberty and the value of free speech and the value of the human spirit, whereas Christianity was completely destructive and taught that essentially if you don't follow our dogma, you know, you're going to get squashed.
Get squashed, go to hell, and we'll muster up a crusade against you because your God's not our God.
Exactly.
Well, and you know, and what you just said rings so true with the headlines. You know, you're saying that these, you know, people with power and influence were above the law. I mean, I just, you know, right before the show started, I printed out an article that said that the Pope is claiming legal immunity. Apparently, I think some of it I'm going by memory, so I hope I have it right. Because he's the head of state, he can't be compelled to testify. And the bishops are defending the cover-up, and somehow they're able to say they didn't work for the Vatican, so they don't have to testify either. I mean, they're hiding behind legal loopholes. You know, and look at what's at stake here. I mean, it, to me, this is so unconscionable. I mean, it's like, deaf children were being molested by these people. It's unthinkable to me that they are getting away with this and there's not an uprising. You better believe if it was Muslims doing this or pagans doing this, somebody would be dragging them out in the street.
Well,
you know?
that's what's so disgusting, Karen, is that if the pagan priests were the first to stand up against this kind of activity, they were the first to come forward because they were the moral authority. They were the legal authority in archaic Greece. So they were the ones to stand up and say, no, this kind of activity has to be punished. That was the basis of Greek law. And that's what's so disgusting, is that these men who call themselves religious, like your beady-eyed Pope, I love the way you describe him, that's true, who, by the way, was a former Nazi, right? So
yes, yeah, the Hitler Youth. How can we forget Ratzinger? You know, I mean, his name, I mean, you know, his name foretold his personality.
Exactly. But he would have been, in antiquity, the priests would have, they were the ones who had to stand up against this. And if they didn't, see, that's the difference. The priests of antiquity believed, and when I say priests, I mean men and women, they believed that if they didn't stand up, the gods would strike them. The gods would punish them. They would lose their right to be able to prophesy.
You know why? And I know why. I know why. Because of Themis. It was up to them to uphold Themis, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And guess what? It was the priestesses who were pushing that. It was the priestesses who stood up and said, guess what, guys? You cannot molest little children. You cannot take somebody off their property and consume their property. You cannot take a woman out in the street and burn her. For whatever reason that you come up with, you have to follow justice. It was the priestesses who taught that. These women who stood up and said, we are nourishers. We are kurotrophoi, they call them, the nourishers of humanity. And the men respected that. And that's what I think is we're missing today in ancient history, is the fact that there's a division of power in antiquity between the men who control the martial element of society and the women who were the judges. Those who maintain the law, those who push science, those who push medicine, those who push democracy, these women balanced with the men to create a society that was far more equitable than what we've got. They would never. The fact that the Pope is hiding behind his big poofy hat and his beady eyes, it's just the Greeks would be disgusted, especially the priestesses. It's amazing.
Well, and you know, and I don't know, I can't even imagine being a Christian and turning the other cheek. I mean, it's so beyond turning another cheek at this point, you know. I mean, but it goes back to, again, you know, people with power and influence are above the law. I mean, when you were describing what they were doing to little boys in catechism, I mean, it sounded like some of the stuff that happened to the prisoners in Abu Ghraib, you know. I mean, it's torture. And look at our enhanced interrogation. You know, they don't even want to call it torture. We're so messed up. We're so messed up. And again, we've lost that balance. The balance. I'm understanding that on a whole new level. I mean, I understood we were out of balance, but I understand now just how much further out of balance we are than I originally even understood, if that makes any sense.
We don't follow Themis anymore. There's no concept. We don't worship justice. We don't worship what is beautiful, you know. And even your guest before was talking about memory. We don't have memory of what really what women once stood for and what men stood up for to protect these women because of what they were teaching. We don't do that. It's all about money now. It's all about power. It's all about greed. It's all about getting for the individual. And guess what? The Greeks taught that when you have a society that's based upon, this is a crazy idea the Greeks had. They thought there were watchers. They call them watchers, episcopal, people who watch. There are divinities who watch. And what these divinities do, these forces do, they go right to the powers that be. As soon as justice is Dike. That's another goddess that nobody ever concentrates on today.
Dike.
She's the daughter of Zeus, the daughter of the age of agriculture, the age of the city. She, if she's violated, these watchers take note of it, and they go right to the powers that be in the council of the gods, both men and women, both male and female, and they report it. And you know what? The gods are said to give the society that violates justice. They give them tyrants, mm-hmm. tyrants to rule over them, and they teach them the lesson of greed. And that's exactly what, you know, it's beautiful. That's exactly what we have going on today.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you're talking about Themis, and I'm thinking about everything going on in the world, you know? I mean, there is absolutely no Themis. And I mean, and it seems like to me, in the it's changed a lot in the last few decades. It seems like it's gotten so much worse just since I've been an adult, you know? I mean, I don't know, it just seems like there was a little bit more integrity a few decades ago, or at least people were trying to put up a subterfuge, at least, that there was integrity. Now it's just all out, do whatever you want, just don't get caught. And even if you do get caught, depending on who you are, there's no consequences.
And that's what brings us right back to Aisa. Again, she is the one, she is the one who's weaving all of this. In the greed that is in the human heart, she weaves that in so that people can look at the story of humanity and say, aha. Aha, look at what's become of humanity. Look at what the Christians preach, and look at what they actually do. That hypocrisy, that's a gift from the gods. The gods are showing you, this goddess Aisa is showing you exactly how bereft of anything good and just that you've become.
Well, and I'm sitting here thinking, too, again, you know, we've gotten everything through the Christian lens, which has warped it all, which has lost the true value. I mean, the Greeks were teaching us, if I'm using the wrong phrase, tell me, but it's almost like they were teaching us universal law, and that totally got thrown out of the window. For what? For Christianity? I mean, what has, I don't know, maybe I am just really warped on the subject these days because the Christian culture seems so ugly in a lot of ways. That's not to say there aren't a lot of good Christian people out there doing good work, but it just seems like there are so many of them that are just hypocrites, or they're like the Pope, who's going to hide behind his loopholes rather than, take his lumps for his mistakes. And, I mean, what kind of role model is that for anybody? You know, he doesn't deserve to be a leader of a spiritual organization when, he's a criminal. You know, he's no better than Cheney or Bush or, you know, any of these other people that, have done injustice to society. Exactly. And, you know, just because and it's worse almost because I think he claims to be, connected to a higher power, however they would phrase it. I don't know. I'm just disgusted and appalled.
And you know what? He wouldn't. Your disgust is ancient, Karen, because he wouldn't have been tolerated in antiquity. He wouldn't have. One of the priestesses at Delphi would say that guy's got to go. Execute him. And these women had the power to do so, and they did frequently. When somebody went south like this, and a priest, and that's essentially what he is, when a priest went south and started endorsing crimes like he's basically doing by not standing up for what is just, they would say, get rid of him. He's not representative of the gods. He's not representative of beauty. He doesn't represent beauty to the world.
No, this is just sheer ugliness,
yeah.
You know? All of it. I mean, there's so much... so much hatred and divisiveness and ugliness in the world, you know, hidden behind the veil of some religion. I know why Bill Maher is so down on religion, all the time when, you know, this is what we have, as unfortunately such high profile examples of religion. The hypocrisy is just, I can't even language it. It's so staggering.
And that's why the feminine voice is so important. That's why the voice of the sacred feminine is so important, that if we are, as a society, if we are going to restore justice to her rightful position, it has to be the feminine voice that does that. And that kind of segues into the final point that I want to talk about. I don't want to take too much time because I really want to hear your buzz tonight. But if we talk about Dionysus and the followers of Dionysus, these women, these maenads, they were the restorers of justice. Remember, they were the ones who brought back the voice of the sacred feminine. People don't realize it, but Dionysus, the worship of Dionysus is the worship of an ecstatic, oracular cult that promulgated justice.
Okay, so it wasn't just about people who revered the wine god and they were all about inebriation.
Right, that's the Christian, that's looking at it through the Christian lens. That's how we look at if you study Dionysus through the Christian lens, you'll think that, yeah, he's the god of drunkenness and revelry and all that kind of stuff. No, no, no. you look at his actual story, and Euripides in his final play, this is his swan song, was the Bacchae, and it was performed after his death, and the playwrights who supported him, like Sophocles, even honored the fact that he wrote such a beautiful story. And the thing is, it's a story about women. If you want to know what the ancients thought about women, read the Bacchae. It's a beautiful play, and it has to do with Dionysus as the Selumorphon, or the Gunamorph, the Gynamorph. He's always portrayed as a feminine god. He has feminine attributes. He's got, essentially, to make a long story short, he becomes the feminine judge of humanity. And what is beautiful about the story is the entire story of the Bacchae is a story about Dionysus' mom. And that's what's beautiful. She's a mortal. She's not a goddess. She's a mortal. She's just a woman. You know, just a plain woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what happened was she joined in philotes in Greek, which is kind of it's translated as love by the Christian translators. But the problem is it doesn't mean love, because that's a Christian virtue. It means, imagine understanding somebody and admiring them and joining with them mentally. That's what it means.
And it's like a mind meld. I'm thinking Spock and Kirk.
Something like that, yeah. Something like that, sure. And becoming one with somebody who you both have attributes that are mutually respectful. You know, mutually.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she joined with Zeus that way and produced Dionysus, who himself became born of Zeus. And people say, well, it's a story of, you know, she wanted to see Zeus as he really was, a human. She wanted to see the flux, the ether, I told you, this kind of, she wanted to look to the beyond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she wanted to look to the stars and understand the cosmos, and it consumed her. And out of this consumption, out of this extreme love, this joining, was born Dionysus,
mm-hmm.
who himself, most people don't know this, but Dionysus, there was actually oracular shrines to Dionysus with priestesses who gave oracular utterances. People don't realize that. They think he's the god of drunkenness because...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, even you see how they portray Cleopatra with Mark Antony, and, you know, she thought she embodied Isis. They say he thought he embodied Dionysus. And whenever he's depicted, he's this, you know, he's this drunken lech.
Right. Because that's how we want to see the Greeks. We want to see them as a bunch of drunken, you know, no good, you know, drunken knuckleheads, because that's how the Christians wanted to portray them as they were taking over the state.
Right. They demonized them. Well, David, we're running out of time here. Okay. We're going to continue this conversation next Wednesday, right?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, because is there more for us to know about Dionysus? He sounds, you know, you have rehabilitated Dionysus to me tonight already, and I think you probably hardly scratched the surface.
You know, there is more, and I just want your audience to focus, and we'll continue next week, but I want them to focus on the beauty of his mother, his relationship with his mother. That, to me, is the most, it's the most inspiring thing about Dionysus, and it's kind of the point of his existence. It's kind of the point of the whole myth of Dionysus.
Hmm.
So we'll focus on that in the future, but I want to get to your buzz, too, because you had some great comments. You had some great topics.
Well, you know, and I want to just leave you with one last statement. You know, one of the last times you were on the show, you made such an impression on me and some of the other listeners. I think at one point you and I must have said, gee, we wish we had a time machine so that we could go back in time, because we felt like we fit more, you know, in those times of the ancient pagans than we do today. What I forgot to tell you was one of the listeners wrote me and said, no, please, we need you both here today. We so desperately need your voice. Don't go back in time.
Well, that's for you, Karen, because you're able to take the kind of the esoteric stuff that I'm talking about. You're able to translate it. You kind of are the oracular voice that way, and people need to realize that what you're doing is a service to humanity. They need to realize that you are bringing back what the Greeks considered to be such an important element of human life, the sacred feminine. People, your audience needs to know that.
Oh, well, thank you, David, but you're the teacher. I wouldn't know any of this unless you brought it to light, so thank you.
Well, your humility is marked, but I recognize it, but okay.
Okay.
You must know where you stand, Karen, so anyway.
Okay.
Get to your buzz.
Okay, all right, so do you want to hold on while I do the buzz, or do you want me to mute you?
I'll hold on. You just mute me, and I'll just listen. I want to listen.
Okay, all right. Well, listeners, I'm going to start with my new sound effects. I just love my little bees that are part of the What's the Buzz segment. And it was such a pleasure to have David Hillman with us tonight, and he will be back with us next Wednesday. So if you enjoy him as much as I do, please tune back in. But for the What's the Buzz segment, we're going to do this kind of quickly. And surprisingly, this ties into what David and I were just talking about. Maureen Dowd, New York Times writer, says, a nope for the Pope. She says, yep, we need a nope, a nun who is Pope. The Catholic Church can never recover as long as its holy shepherd is seen as a black sheep in the ever-darkening sex abuse scandal. Now we learn the sickening news that Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, nicknamed God's Rottweiler when he was the Church's enforcer on matters of faith and sin, ignored repeating warnings and looked away in the case of Reverend Lawrence Murphy, a Wisconsin priest who molested as many as 200 deaf boys. It's appalling. The Church has been tone-deaf and dumb on the scandal for so long it's shocking, but not surprising to learn from the Times' Lori Goodstein that a group of deaf former students spent 30 years trying to get church leaders to pay attention. Victims give similar accounts of Father Murphy's pulling down their pants and touching them in his office, his car, his mother's country house, on class excursions and fundraising trips, and in their dormitory beds at night. Author Budinsky, Goodstein writes, said he was the first molested when he went to Father Murphy for confession when he was about 12 in 1960. It was only when the sanctity of the confessional was breached that an archbishop in Wisconsin, who later had to resign when it turned out he used church money to pay off a male lover, wrote to Cardinal Ratzinger at the Vatican to request that Father Murphy be defrocked. The cardinal did not answer. The archbishop wrote to a different Vatican official, but Father Murphy appealed to Cardinal Ratzinger for leniency and got it, partly because of the church's statute of limitations. And Maureen Dowd aptly says, since when does sin have a statute of limitations? The article is a bit longer. She goes on and says, Pope Benedict has continued the church's ban on female priests and is adamant against priests having wives. He started two investigations of American nuns to check on their quality of life, which is really code for seeing if they've grown too independent. As a cardinal, he wrote a Vatican document urging women to be submissive partners and not take on adversarial roles toward men. Anyway, I think Maureen's article is definitely worth reading. Please go to the New York Times online. It was posted on March 28th, and she closes by saying, the nuns have historically cleaned up the messes of priests, and this is a historic mess. Benedict should go home to Bavaria, and the cardinal should send the white smoke up the chimney proclaiming habeas mama. So, yes, we need a nun. We need a nope, not a pope. The next thing before we run out of time tonight is some insightful comments from one of my listeners talking about some previous articles of mine and TV shows about the dumbing down of America and the part that Fox News and Rupert Murdoch plays. In this. Well, this listener is from Europe, and he says, I don't know if you're aware of the background of the media baron Rupert Murdoch, who owns and controls the multinational conglomerate, which we call News Corpse, C-O-R-P-S-E, over here, and which runs the Fox Network and MySpace, as well as Sky Network and a whole host of other media channels and American newspapers. Although its founder proclaims himself to be a born-again evangelical with a strict moral code, he's also one of the major sources of soft core porn, and the entire media. His first purchase in the UK was the News of the World, which is roughly equivalent to the American scandal sheet, the National Enquirer. Then he bought the Sun, which was a tabloid newspaper, which is practically a comic book in terms of its reading age. One of the most famous features of the Sun are its page three girls, who are topless models, often surgically enhanced from a very young age. The next major purchase was the Times of London, which was once the most highly respected newspaper in the UK in terms of the fairness and accuracy of its news coverage, but it is now just another news corpse product, and its reputation has plummeted. He goes on to say Rupert has made it plain that his media empire controls who is and who is not going to win elections or be considered fit for the position of prime minister, and he's made that very clear when he refused to meet with Michael Howard, who was the leader of the Conservative Party, similar to our Republicans. And then shortly afterwards, George W. Also refused to meet with him at the White House. After this, Howard was deposed. And we see Rupert is actually controlling what Americans think these days, too, and who should be in power. Well, under George W., the protections against a foreign investor controlling more than one branch of the American media were secretly relaxed, which allows News Corps to expand to something like a de facto monopoly. Every single one of the News Corps products seems to be determined to push forward a dumbing down agenda and to encourage the rise of the gullible religious right, thanks to the successful strategies of Karl Rove. It should be easy for you to check each and every one of these details out for yourself, and if you have any contacts in the UK, then I'm sure you'll hear a lot of the same things from them. The assumption seems to be that the uneducated people are more likely to become fundamentalists and to support a militaristic agenda as part of some end times theology. Anyway, makes sense to me, and I thank this listener for sending this along, because it just furthers furthers the story and gives us more pieces of the license to use them, but they must use them in the public interest and to advance democracy. Well, we can see the distortion of that, can't we? He goes on to say, this is Kennedy, if the fairness doctrine was still in place, you could not have a Fox News, nor a Rush Limbaugh, for that matter. But the doctrine is gone, and Fox and Limbaugh are here. Quoting the Pew Research, Kennedy said 30% of Americans now get their news from talk radio, which is 90% dominated by the right. Another large number of Americans say their primary free speech to preach against lifestyles of people they didn't agree with, like gays. But what they did, they didn't recognize what they did. They ended up actually, as they attempted to strip gays of hate crimes protection, they ended up actually removing protections for race and religion instead. And the bill in its current form doesn't actually take rights away from gays and lesbians. It takes away rights for religion and race. So they think the bill will likely be modified before it's voted on in the House, but the writer of the article said people who consider themselves Jewish, black, even Christian, should be outraged. What a dumb, dumb mistake. Anyway, that article comes from Igor Volsky, and he writes for thinkprogress.org. I wanted to end on an up note tonight, because we've been talking about some pretty heavy stuff. So I think for a little bit of humor, I'm going to read you something one of my listeners sent me that I really got a nice chuckle from. And it calls, "It All Depends on Who Writes History." Isn't that always the theme here? It all depends on who writes history. And this is Eve's conversation with God. And it goes like this. "Lord, I have a problem." "What's the problem, Eve?" "Well," Eve says, "I know that you created me and provided this beautiful garden and all of these wonderful animals, as well as that hilarious comedic snake, but I'm just not happy." And God says, "Well, why not, Eve? Why is that?" And Eve says, "Lord, I'm lonely and I'm sick to death of apples." God says, "Well, Eve, in that case, I have a solution. I'll create a man for you." Eve says, "Man, what is that, Lord?" And God says, "A flawed creature with many bad habits. He'll probably lie and cheat and be vain. All in all, he'll give you a hard time, but he'll be bigger, faster, and will like to hunt and kill things." I'll create him in such a way that he will satisfy your physical needs. He will be witless and will revel in childish things like fighting and kicking a ball about. He won't be as smart as you, so he'll also need your advice to think properly." Well, Eve says, "Well, that sounds great," and she, with an ironic raised eyebrow, "but what's the catch, Lord?" And God says, "Well, you can have him on one condition." And Eve says, "Well, what's that, Lord?" And God says, "As I said, he'll be proud, arrogant, and self-admiring, so you'll have to let him believe that I made him first, and it will have to be our little secret, you know, woman to woman." Anyway, I thought that was funny. So God is a woman, and she's given Eve a play toy. And man, you like that, David?
Yeah, very much.
It was just a joke. You know I love man.
Of course.
Well, that concludes our What's the Buzz segment for tonight. So I'm going to let you hear my swarm of bees for a minute. And as long as you keep telling me you think it's important, I'll keep shedding light on ideals of the sacred feminine, which are being honored or not around the world, because we have to be aware, we have to counter the toxicity and the imbalance. Because remember, and I hope you're not tired of hearing me say it, I think it deserves a bumper sticker, actually. It will be Western women and our like-minded brothers who will save the world, and we will. We'll do it with our thoughts, our words, our deeds. As we will it, so shall it be. So, as we come to a close with tonight's show, I want to just leave you with a little prayer that will take you into the next week until we meet again next Wednesday. So often I like to read the prayers that come from the Goddess Temple down in Orange County. They mail me one every month. And so I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me and bring an even deeper focus to these lovely words. Great Goddess, the life force and all quickens within as the season lifts from the dark of winter to the growing light of spring. With gentle anticipation, I feel myself enlivening in a fresh new way, once again expecting powerful and good things to continue to blossom in my life, just as spring will blossom into the fruiting of the summer. I am deeply grateful for my part in the great wheel of life. I stand in reverence to all forms of you. Thank you, Mother, and blessed be. Well, good night, listeners, and thanks for tuning in. I hope you've enjoyed our wonderful guests tonight, Julie Raymond and David Hillman. And David will be back with us next Wednesday to continue our conversation about Dionysus and his mother and the Naiads. So until next Wednesday, good night, and may she embrace you in her golden wings.